If you would like to be turning to John chapter 14, I'm going to read the first 14 verses in just a minute. But before I do that, let me take this occasion to thank this congregation for having me come down. First time I preached in Memphis, it's been a wonderful experience for me. I appreciate Cloyce saying whatever he had to say for you to agree for me to come down. Cloyce and Thea are special friends. And to get to meet you and to know you and to figure out some of the connections we have with one another. And Dan and Kelly are back tonight, and that's just really has made my week to get to see them again. And it's really hard to get people to come out on Friday and Saturday nights for gospel preaching, but that's the way this meeting broke, and the attendance, I think, has just been wonderful every assembly we've had. And I'm going to ask God's blessing to be richly upon you, and I hope the time will not be long before somehow or other we can be together again. So thank you from my heart for the invitation and for the hospitality and the kindness that you've shown me while I've been down here. Now I want to read John chapter 14, beginning with verse 1 through verse 14. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. And I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also, and from now on you know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is sufficient for us. Jesus said to him, Have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father, so how can you say, Show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father in me? The words that I speak to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves. Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father. And whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it. For the longest time in my life, death has been a distant rumor. But that's no longer the case. I've gotten to the point where hardly a month goes by, sometimes it seems like hardly a week goes by, that a good friend from many years ago dies. When I was in Florida College, I had four different roommates. Two of them have already died. The third is not in good shape. And to realize we've gotten to that point where our 70 years has been met, hopefully by reason of strength, we'll see 80 or longer. But to get to that point where death becomes the rule rather than the exception, that can be a very jarring situation for an individual, especially one who's not prepared for it. And here in John 14, Christ addresses that problem. And I would like to speak about what Christ says about the matter of death this evening. He starts out by saying, let not your heart be troubled. And the word troubled, I talked about this last night from 1 Peter 3, but the word troubled means to be agitated, to be stirred up. Back in chapter 5 of John, we read that there would be a troubling of the pool when an angel would come down and touch it. The water would start roiling and people would try to get into the pool for healing. And so to be troubled is to be uneasy, to be agitated, maybe anxious, nervous about something. Christ tells us, let not your heart be troubled. Now, I find that interesting that he would say that to us in light of what we can read in the context leading up to John 14. Go back to chapter 11 and look at verse 33. This is the story of Lazarus, the only staged miracle that Christ performed in the Gospels, where he held off rushing to the side of, of a sick individual. He held off in order to make a greater statement about his power and his glory. But in verse 33, when Jesus finally gets to Bethany and they take him out to the tomb, and when he saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And then turn the page to chapter 12 and look at verse 27. Christ says, "Now my soul is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I came to this hour." And I think I said this morning that although the Jews tried to apprehend Christ many times and silence him, every time they attempted it, they failed, because the Gospel of John says his hour had not yet come. His moment of destiny had not arrived. But now in chapter 12 of John, it has arrived, and the perception of that in his spirit was troubling to him, that the time of his death had come. And Christ shows his humanity so plainly in this. He said, "Should I ask the Father to save me from this hour? I'm not going to ask that. It's for this hour that I came into this world." But look at Mark 14, verse 35. Just a few days later, after he said, "I'm not going to ask the Father to save me from this hour," Christ is asking the Father to save him from this hour. That's the way we are. That's the way humanity is. Little do we know or realize the depths to which we might descend when we find ourselves in some crisis. At the end of chapter 13, Peter says, "Lord, I'm going to lay down my life for you. I don't know about these others. You might not be able to trust them, but you can trust me. I'm going to lay down my life for you." Christ says, "No, Peter. Before the dawn comes up tomorrow, you will have denied me three times." And Christ shows his humanity in asking for the very thing he said he was not going to ask for. And knowing that the time of his death was approaching was troubling to him. And then look at chapter 13, right there again at the end, verse 21. Jesus is troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." So how can Christ tell us not to be troubled when we read these three occasions of himself being troubled? Well, he can tell us not to be troubled because he knows what lies ahead for us. And in these other instances, he showed himself to be just like us, made in all points like as we, expressing in himself our true humanity. But when Christ speaks in John 14, he's speaking as the Son of God. He's speaking with the omnipotence, omniscience of deity. And he's speaking about death. And we need to pay attention carefully to what he says about death here, because what he says will help us when we are troubled by the thought of our approaching deaths. "Let not your hearts be troubled." I said last night there are times when fear is a reflex reaction. Amos 3, verse 8, "The lions roared, who's not going to shake in his boots?" But we are not to let fear become a controlling factor in our life. And if we'll listen to what Christ says about death, it won't be. I think the most honest prayer in the Bible is the father who had brought the demonized son to the apostles. Jesus, Peter, James, and John are on top of the mountain transfiguration. They come down from the mountain. Christ sees a commotion going on. The father comes up. He asks what happened. And the man says, "Well, your apostles, disciples, tried to cast the demon out of my boy, and they failed." And that really upset Jesus, at the failure of his men to do what he had given them the power to do. So Christ is going to step in and clean up their mess. And he asks the man, "Do you believe that I can do this?" The man indicates, "Lord, if you will." "What do you mean, if I will?" "Of course I will." Do you believe I can do this? Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. Now that's me. I believe I don't have anything to worry about in regard to death, but I worry. I believe what Christ has said about eternity, but there are times I'm still anxious. And so our study tonight hopefully will help us in our unbelief, in our difficulty in fully accepting and embracing and living in the truth of what Christ has said. And there are three points I would like to make from John 14. I want to start by talking about a place, and then we're going to talk about a person, and then we're going to talk about a promise. And I will begin by saying what Jesus says in verse 1, the antidote to anxiety in regard to death is always trust God. You believe in God, believe also in me. Believe what Jesus tells us here. So let's start by talking about the place. Have you ever noticed in verse 2 that there are three words that Christ uses to describe what lies on the other side of death? In my Father's house are many mansions, and I go to prepare a place. What's on the other side of death? A Father's house. When I was a young preacher about 100 years ago, I would often do door-to-door work, knocking on doors, just going throughout the neighborhood. I was living in Kentucky at the time, Louisville. And I'll be quite honest and tell you, there were times I was hoping nobody answered the door. I mean, that was just tough for me to go door-to-door, knocking, the cold calling kind of thing, trying to get somebody to let me put my foot in the door so that I could go in and have a Bible study with them. And many times I was hoping they would either not answer the door or they weren't home, because that was just tough for me to do. I had a lot of apprehension about that. But I'll tell you what, I never had any apprehension, anxiety about going to my Father's house, about going home. I was raised in a ramshackle farmhouse that was as old as the hills the dad tried to fix up over the years. I doubt if any of you today, considering the kinds of homes we live in today, would even think about living in the place I grew up. But you know what? When I think about my Father's house, that's a Thomas Kincaid painting to me. You've seen the paintings of the homes out in the woods, and it's twilight or dark, and that warm golden light pouring out of the windows. That's where I grew up. My Father's house. George MacDonald was a Scottish preacher who had a great influence on J.R.R. Tolkien and on C.S. Lewis. And one of the truths that MacDonald came to realize, he was raised in a very strict, rigid, nobody do any smiling, Calvinistic home. The kind of home where God was conceived of as someone leaning over the balustrades of heaven, and if he sees any of us having a good time, he yells down, "Knock it off!" That's the kind of home he was raised in. And by his own study of Scripture, he came to realize that God is not a hanging judge, he is a loving Father. And that especially impressed Lewis. And Lewis, because of MacDonald, came to understand that the center of all reality, what is at the center of the universe, is a loving Father. That's what awaits us on the other side. His house. Christ says, "If it were not so, I would have told you." If there was something to worry about, if there was something to be anxious about, concerned about, I would have told you. There's nothing to tell. 30 years ago or so, I had to go in for a biopsy, some kind of, you know, procedure. Nothing serious, but they wanted to do a biopsy. I can remember awakening there in the hospital room, and I look over and the doctor's standing at the counter writing something. And I remember saying to him in all of my grogginess, "Do I have anything to worry about?" He didn't say a word. He just looked at me and went, that's all he did. If there was something to worry about, he would have told me. On the other side is our Father's house, and it's called a mansion. And I get really irritated with some of these modern translators who think that mansion is not the right conception for the Greek word here. The word translated mansion only appears one other time in the Bible. It appears the second time in this very chapter. Look at verse 23. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. Some versions say abiding place. In my Father's house are many abiding places. Now, I'm not saying that mansion is the best translation. I'm saying mansion is the best exposition. I mean, if we can't think of heaven, our Father's house, as a mansion, is it a two-bedroom apartment? Is it some kind of condo? I mean, why does mansion not fit how we think about our Father's house? Paul told the Corinthians, the people in the town where they had that great temple of Diana, one of the seven wonders of the world. And I mean, they knew about temples in Corinth. But Paul tells that little group of Christians, you are the temple of God. Now, if we can be the temple of God, I have no problem thinking of my Father's house as a mansion. There's no term that better conveys the grandeur and the magnificence of the home that's in heaven. And it's a place. I go to prepare a place. It's an actual place. It's just not something in the by and by. It's an actual place where we will be. I heard a fellow talking one time about overhearing a couple of ladies talking about a friend of theirs who should have already been dead, but she's just hanging on. And they're talking that, well, one says, I wonder how she's able to hang on, and she just hasn't died already. And the other said, well, maybe Christ isn't finished preparing her place. Well, what a bunch of nonsense. When Christ said, I go to prepare, he's going to the cross. That's where he went to prepare our place. And at Calvary, he said, it's finished. He's done the work. The place is prepared. So we can think of what's on the other side in terms of a location where there's a house, a mansion, where there's a place for us. And then, let's talk from verses 7 to 11 about the person who is there. The person who is there is Christ, and Christ's argument in verses 7 to 11 is that when you see me, you are seeing God. If you had known me, you would have also known my Father. From now on, you know him and have seen him because you know me and have seen me. And Philip didn't understand. Verse 8, in the Gospel of John, folks, conversation often occurs on two levels. Christ says something up here, and the person he's talking to is interpreting down here. Except you be born again, Nicodemus. Well, how can a man enter his mother's womb and be born again? That goes on throughout the Gospel of John. Christ is speaking on a higher plane than men are perceiving. And that happens here. Christ said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Philip says, no, we've not seen him. Show him us, show him to us, and that will be sufficient for us. Now, Philip was one of the earliest of Christ's disciples. And he was a disciple for whom the glass was often half empty. Back in John chapter 6, 5,000 people followed Jesus. He's trying to get away from the people with his disciples for a little rest and recreation. He's got something very important he's wanting to talk to them about. And what that is explained in Matthew 16, verses 13 and following. But he's trying to get away from the crowds, but they follow him around the lake. And when he and the disciples arrive at the far shore, 5,000 plus people are there waiting for him. And instead of being aggravated, I mean, I've gotten calls at midnight on Saturday night I didn't need to get. You know, nobody need to call me that late at night, but sometimes I've gotten those calls. And I tend to be a little bit aggravated, but Christ was not aggravated. He taught, he healed, and then toward the end of the day, he told the disciples, now, fix these folks something to eat. Now, Christ wasn't going to feed them because they were in danger of collapsing due to hunger. I mean, they'd come out from their homes that very day. They had enough strength to get back home, but Christ said, fix them something to eat. You know why he said that? Because love is kind. There are times Jesus did things simply because he was kind. My mother was kind. If you had come to our house, you wouldn't have gotten out of there without mom feeding you. And Christ, being kind, said, fix them something to eat. And Philip said, what are you talking about? If we had 200 denarii, which means if we had almost two-thirds of a year's salary, we still wouldn't have enough money to feed this crowd. It would not be sufficient, Philip said. And here he uses that same word, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough. That will satisfy us. It's sufficient. There was a time when Paul thought his life situation was insufficient. And Christ had to tell him, my grace is enough, Paul. My grace is sufficient. So Philip says, Lord, it's not enough. We really want to see the Father. And Philip's talking about a physical visage, a physical figure. And in verse 9, Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. Philip, the Father and I are twins. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you saw the Father, you wouldn't see any more than what you're already seeing in me. The words that I speak are the very words the Father gives me to speak. The works that I do are the very works that the Father gives me to do. In every way, we're on the same page. Look at Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, that great description of Christ in his relation to God and in his relation to man. And in his relation to God, the text says that he is the brightness of his image and the express image of his person. The brightness of his image. We used to have fluorescent light bulbs that had in them a filament. And you flip the switch and that filament comes on, and there is an outshining into the room from that filament. There is brightness that comes from that filament. That outshining is the same light that is there in the center of the bulb, in the filament. It's different, but it's the same. Christ is the outshining of God, the brightness of his glory, the express image, the identical image of God. What Jesus is saying is that there is nothing in the Father that you do not see in me. Nothing. That's what awaits us on the other side. You want to know what God's like? Make a study of Jesus Christ. In his kindness, in his compassion, in all of his attributes, that's who awaits us on the other side. I want to give you three reasons for being full of hope about what happens when we step over. Number one, our defense attorney and the judge are on the same team. You know, we think of God being the judge, and we're going to stand before the judge. Well, the Bible says that our advocate, our defense attorney who is representing us and arguing our case, he and the judge are in complete agreement. Now, that's not the way it is in criminal courts. That's not the way it is in civil courts. But that's the way it is in heaven. In the book of Zechariah, there's this wonderful scene where the high priest is hauled in before the judge, and the prosecutor, the devil, the accuser, the adversary, is there saying, "Judge, would you look at this high priest, Joshua? You made him your high priest. Look how dirty he is. Look how filthy he is." And the devil was telling the truth. The devil's never had to lie about me. Now, I know he's a liar and has been a liar from the beginning, but he's never had to lie about me. I've given him plenty of ammunition. And what would you expect the judge to do when the prosecutor's argument is valid? Well, you'd expect him to bring down the gavel and to condemn the accused. But sitting by Joshua was an advocate, was a defense attorney, and the advocate stands and says, "Father, what the prosecution has to say is true, but I've already paid the penalty. I've paid the price." And the judge hears that and says, "Well, in that case, case dismissed." Now, that's what awaits on the other side. A defense attorney and a judge who are on the same page. Secondly, be confident, be full of hope. Because we have God's own invitation telling us, "Everyone who thirsts, come drink. If you're broke and don't have any money, that's all right. Come anyway and buy anything you want." And the third reason, and maybe the most profound of all of them, is our own wretchedness. One of the reasons we have for hope in eternity is our own wretchedness. That sounds counterintuitive. But on the other side is a being who is pure mercy. Mercy is that quality of love that cannot look at someone's hurt, someone's misery, someone's wretchedness, and just turn and walk away from it. Mercy is that quality that does everything it can to help the hurting. And we'll be standing there knowing what we've done in this life, fearful because of the guilt we've accrued, before the most merciful of beings. My prayer, my last prayer, if I'm conscious and can say it, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." That's what awaits on the other side. And then thirdly is this promise. Having talked about the place and the person, verses 12 through 14, verse 12, "Most assuredly, verily, verily, I say unto you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to my Father." I think in the context, Christ is speaking directly to the apostles, assuring them that in the work he is sending them out on, he will equip them with everything that they need. And he says, not only will you do what I've done, you'll do things greater than I have done. Now, how can that be? How can you do something greater than raising Lazarus from the dead? How can you do something greater than feeding 5,000 people? I'll tell you how. Raising the dead in sin is not a miracle, but it's a greater work than raising Lazarus from the dead. Baptizing 5,000 people, like the book of Acts talks about, that's not a miracle. But it's a greater work than feeding 5,000 people. Acts 4, verse 4. So Christ is giving a promise to his apostles, but then he adds this. Whatever you ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it. And it sounds like Christ is giving the disciples a carte blanche. Anything you want, anything you need, just ask and you'll get it. Well, I don't think Christ is giving the disciples a blank check here. I don't think God hands anybody a blank check for the very fact that we cannot be trusted. We can't be trusted to ask for what we really need. I think what God is saying to his apostles is, in the work I am giving you and sending you out, everything you need to carry out the commission you're receiving from me, you will have. If you're in trouble, don't worry. Help will come. If you don't know what to say, don't worry. It will be given you in that hour what to say. And I think we can make an application of verse 13 and 14 to the situation we've been talking about with the problem of death. If we're anxious, nervous, troubled by the thought of our death and our frailty and our physical debility and our getting old, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Give me the word, give me the friend, give me the strength I need to finish well. Proverbs 28:23, verse 18 says, surely there is a hereafter. And I think our Father will give us what we need to meet that hour. If you believe in Jesus, death is not death. I mean, that's what he said at the house of Lazarus, Mary and Martha. He who believes in me shall never die. Do you believe that? Martha says, oh, I know, Jesus, that in the resurrection of the last day, the dead will be raised. I know all of that. Jesus says, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And if you wore glasses, I can imagine him taking them off and leaning into Martha and saying, Martha, you're looking at the resurrection and the life. And to demonstrate that, he raised Lazarus from the dead. Jesus is the one we need for our greatest problem. I spoke this morning about C.S. Lewis and the Hideous Strength. Or maybe it was last night, I guess, I spoke about it. But the Chronicles of Narnia are far better known to people today than his science fiction trilogy. And at the end of the very last book, The Last Battle is the name of the book, there's a train accident, and the four children who have been the protagonists throughout all the stories, the four children don't realize that they are killed in that accident. All they know is that they're with Aslan, and Narnia has never looked more spectacular to them. It's never looked more awe-inspiring to them. And finally, Aslan has to explain to them that there was an accident and you're dead. They didn't know it. I was sitting right by Mom's side when she died. I guess I was the last person she ever saw, and I've wondered if when she opened her eyes the next time, she was looking for me. And maybe was surprised that she wasn't seeing me. I wonder if she even knew she had died. Here's how Aslan explains to the children what had happened. And I'm going to take Lewis's English terminology and translate it into an American school person's child's terminology. Let me tell you what dead means, Aslan says. Dead means that the semester is over and summer vacation has begun. That's what dead means. Lewis said all their life, the children's life up to that point, had been nothing but the cover and title page of their story. But now, they were at chapter one of the great story that would go on forever, in which every chapter to come was better than the one that preceded. Now, I think I've got a verse for that. Let's close by going to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 7. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 7, where Paul says that in the ages to come, he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. In the ages to come, the exceeding riches of his grace. I perceive of heaven as being a great unpacking of God's infinite, eternal riches that never run out, that never have to be repeated. I see heaven as a great adventure where we always have something great that involves us at the moment, but there's something greater that we know is coming and we look forward to it. And an infinite God can make that happen. As we start the great story, and every chapter is better than the one that we had just lived. Ian MacLean wrote some really great stories. He was a Scottish writer around the end of the 19th century. And he wrote about the village of Drumtaki, just a mythical village that he created, kind of like the Brigadoon story, except this village didn't appear just once every 100 years. It was there all the time. And he talks about the people who lived there and their lives, and the doctor who lived there, and Drumshoe, the school teacher. And these two men, the doctor, McLaren, was not a believer. Drumshoe was a great believer, but they were great friends, and they had grown old in that village. Drumshoe teaching, McLaren healing. And it was Christmas, and it's late, the fire is growing lower in the fireplace, and they're talking, and Drumshoe says, I don't know how long I have for this world, but I hope there is someone to speak a good word for me in the hereafter. And McLean got up, said his goodbyes, and went home through the snow and the ice of Christmas evening. Drumshoe is there by the fire in his comfortable chair with his pet dog, and in the morning they found him dead. And when our hour comes, we will find someone to speak a good word for us. And the judge happens to be on his side. If you're here tonight and you want to be part of that great blessing, you can do something about it if you've not already, by surrendering your life on God's terms to him. The blood's been shed. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Christ's blood has been shed. It will wash your sins if you will obey him in baptism. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. If that conviction is on your heart and you're wanting to do something about it now, we hope you will and come while together we stand and while we sing.